So you have lived in the Middle East for a long time. Can you tell me just a little bit about that?
Sure. I actually went to the Middle East in 1974 when I was very young, really fresh out of college, to teach English in Egyptian schools. I taught for a year in Cairo and then 2 years in Upper Egypt, and I started to study Arabic while I was there. And then when I came back after the 3 year period and went to graduate school for 2 years, and I studied Near Eastern Studies at the University of Michigan. Primarily, it was Arabic with a bit of history and anthropology and political science, economics. And then I went back to Egypt and lived in the Sinai right after the Israeli withdrawal from the Sinai that President Jimmy Carter had brokered through the Camp David Accords. So I ended up living in a little house under the date palms in El Arish, which is North Sinai. It's on the Mediterranean. So I had a little house on the Mediterranean Sea. And I ran an income-generating project for women, a needlework project that is still going on. That was in 79 to 82. And we did some other projects, an irrigation project out in Wadi El Arish. Then I came back to this country and lived in Washington, worked on a scholarship program that educated Palestinian university faculty in this country for master's and PhDs. We had even students at the University of Wisconsin in both master's and PhD programs. So they returned then to their universities to teach, and they were obligated to do so, and they did return, and it was an amazing program. I did that, and then I moved to to East Jerusalem and lived there for 3 years. Moved back to Cairo for another 3 years. Moved to Wausau and Madison for 4 years. Moved back to Cairo. Moved back to Jerusalem, and then down to Tel Aviv. Came back here to this house in the North Woods, and went to Lebanon for 2 years. And we came back 6 years ago. So 27 years in the Middle East, 15 in Egypt, 10 in Palestine, and 2 in Lebanon. And now about 7.5 years in Harshal.
So it sounds like you're a slouch. It's an,
Yeah, I'm a slouch.
So it sounds like most of those places are predominantly Muslim.
Right.
What is the biggest difference between living in a Muslim country and living in a predominantly Christian country?
You know, you'll probably be shocked to hear me say this because it is the antithesis of what we have been hearing and in some ways seeing. But I found the Muslims that I met in the Middle East were the most tolerant people. They were tolerant of me as a Western Christian. They were welcoming. They were hospitable. They would say things like, "Merry Christmas." It didn't seem to hurt them to say, you know, to wish you Happy Easter, to wish you Merry Christmas. And I find, you know, I found in a lot of ways it was hard for Western Christians to reciprocate to them and say, "Happy Eid, Happy Ramadan." You know, we were less tolerant, I felt, of them in their religion than they were of us in ours. Obviously, that dialogue looks different now because of acts of terror committed in the name of Islam. But the majority of people who are Muslim in the Muslim world, of course they don't agree with those acts of terror, and they don't believe that that represents the kind of Muslims that they are. But anyway, yes, very welcoming, very tolerant.
So why would you th do why do you think that there is this negative why do you think there is this negative stigma towards Islam?
I think it is because of 9/11 and because of many, many heinous acts of violence that have taken the lives of many innocent people. And, you know, as long as it's committed by someone who is a Muslim, who has a Muslim name, and who says or claims that he has done it in the name of Islam. This makes people who don't know about Islam very uncomfortable and very suspicious and angry. I mean, it makes me angry because I feel like, you know, they make the world a dangerous place, and they make it hard for people to then be tolerant and accepting, which is what we try to teach our children to be. It's what we think our world and our society should be like.
So you said you lived in the more conflicted areas of Israel and in places like that. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I'd be happy to. We lived in East Jerusalem, which has been traditionally the Palestinian part of Jerusalem. We also have lived in the West Bank city of Ramallah, which is kind of the de facto capital of Ramallah. It's where the Palestinian Authority government offices now are. We never lived in Gaza, but we visited Gaza, and in our work, I had an office in Gaza that I needed to relate to. So I would travel down through the checkpoint at Erez, which is a massive, ugly checkpoint with barbed wire and very high fences and, metal detectors and soldiers prepared to shoot. And it's a very nasty barrier between Gaza and Israel proper. So anyway, so we lived and worked with Palestinians in what are called the Israeli occupied territories. And those are West Bank and Gaza. There is also the Golan Heights, which is occupied by Israel. We weren't involved in working there at all. But so our work was with Palestinians, and therefore when we talk about where we lived and where we worked, we do refer to it as Palestine, which makes people a little uncertain, a little unsure, what are we talking about? Because there is no country right now on the map that says Palestine in most maps of the world. But these are the areas that are predominantly Palestinian. However, the Israelis have built, I actually don't remember the number, I think more than 100 settlements in the occupied West Bank. So there are Jewish Israeli settlers living in those settlements on the West Bank, which has essentially de facto created a situation in which the West Bank, they won't return the West Bank. Because they can't. They've not only occupied it, they've colonized it. So talking with the Palestinians about a two-state solution, where would that state be? It would be Gaza. Which is a narrow strip of land, isolated, and then it would be this patchwork quilt of unconnected pieces of land in the West Bank, and then East Jerusalem is somehow attached to that but also separated from it, so that if you're in Ramallah or you're in Bethlehem and you want to go to East Jerusalem, you can't, because East Jerusalem is occupied by the Israelis too, and they don't allow you to come in without a permit unless you have an East Jerusalem ID.
Sounds like Berlin.
Yeah, it's worse in a way than Berlin. And anyway, the Berlin Wall fell, didn't it? And now you have a unified Berlin. Of course, the Israelis say that Jerusalem has been unified. They unified it, they say.
Why do you think that so much of the world has been in support, or at least not in objection, to what the Israelis have been doing?
I think a lot of it has to do with the Holocaust and the guilt that the West feels, because stories about what was going on were leaking out. I'm sure there were people in power in the Western governments who probably knew what the Nazis were doing. And did they do anything to lift a finger to save Jewish people? They did not. So, and then it was also very easy for the Western countries through the United Nations in 1947 to partition Palestine because it wasn't theirs. They gave away somebody else's farm. They didn't volunteer their own, we didn't say, oh, well, we'll give them the state of Indiana. The Germans didn't say, we'll give them Bavaria. They can create. The Germans should have been the one to pay the price. Why didn't Germany carve out a section for Jews to make a homeland in? Even the Germans for committing the Holocaust weren't required to pay a price, a moral price they paid. In terms of conscience, I'm sure many Germans feel morally convicted, but they didn't pay a price in terms of sacrificing land, for instance. So yes, we'll give them Palestine. And then also the Jews in Western Europe, not only motivated by the Holocaust, but motivated before the Holocaust, because Theodor Herzl founded Zionism. And he, famously, the Zionists said, Palestine is a land without a people for a people without a land. Well, excuse me, that was fallacious. There were people there. They were called Palestinians. You just chose to overlook their existence. Now, this isn't the first time this has happened in history. We have a very good example of it here in our own country. We came in, we said it was our manifest destiny to occupy this continent, as though there weren't Native Americans here who already lived here and had a way of life here. No, they didn't exist and they were in our way, and we either eliminated them or corralled them. So we have the same thing going on.
Yeah, we definitely do. So you're arguing that the reason these challenges are here are because of what they've done in the past, essentially.
And there is
Or
also a link, there is a large group of people in this country, many of whom would identify with Christian fundamentalism, who believe because of their interpretation, their reading of the Bible, that Israel was going to come into existence again as a modern state, as part of God's plan for the end of times. It's not because, fundamentalist Christians are great lovers of the Jews.
I had a good question, now I can't remember it.
Thing, a
Sure.
lot of people who have Arab sympathies also feel that for a very, very long time, the press in this country was highly dominated by a pro-Israel contingent. And you could tell that by the way the news was reported. And it's still, frankly, that way a bit with NPR. I listen to Morning Edition and All Things Considered practically every day. But I notice that their criticisms, or the way they report the news out of West Bank and Gaza, is always pretty gingerly. Even the New York Times has gotten to be much stronger in reporting a clearer picture, I think, about what's really happening on the ground. And I think young people, including young American Jews, have a very different attitude towards Israel than their parents had. Because they see, because they do believe the Palestinians are occupied wrongfully. They believe, that the occupation is holding them back, holding them down economically, that they don't have freedom, and they feel very bad that as Jews, they're perpetuating oppression, because traditionally they feel that Jews were always supportive of the underdog since they themselves were
They have
underdogs.
been the underdog for 2,000 years,
Yeah.
yeah. Why is Palestine so important to Muslim people?
Well, it's the city of Jerusalem is the second most, or you could say third most holy place after Mecca and Medina. So when you go on pilgrimage, when you go on the Hajj in Islam, you go to Mecca and Medina. But people also revere Jerusalem as a very important city. They have a major, they have two major mosques there. They have Al-Aqsa Mosque, and then they have the Dome of the Rock. So it's a compound there that they revere and that people wish to go there to pray on Fridays. And mostly they're prevented from doing so now if they're from the West Bank. The only people who can go are people who actually reside in Jerusalem.
What do you think? So you said a two-state solution is becoming more and more less like, or less and less likely,
right?
Because of the settlements that they have. What do you think is a good solution at this?
Well, a lot of people talk about a one-state solution, in which Palestinians are full citizens, with equal rights and equal opportunities. Now, mind you, if that happens, then the country is no longer a Jewish state,
mm-hmm.
because with inside what is now called Israel, 20% of the population already is Arab. Those are the people who didn't flee, who weren't driven out of their villages, mostly in the Galilee. Most of the other villages were destroyed. People can't go back to them. So they fled to Gaza. They fled to the West Bank. They even fled to the East Bank of the Jordan, which is the country of Jordan. They fled to Syria. They fled to Lebanon. So you have large camps, refugee camps, still in those countries. But if you had a one-state solution and you allowed, you know, the Palestinians one vote for each person, especially if all the refugees came back, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, and the population of the West Bank and Gaza, you would have, I'm sure, I haven't actually sat down and done the math, you would have more Muslims than you would have Jews. You would no longer have a Jewish state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the interesting thing is that a lot of Israelis are not practicing Jews. They aren't people who regularly go to temple or who are observant of Jewish holidays. Well, they might observe the holidays, but they don't observe them in a religious way. They observe them in a cultural way. And of course, having come from countries where they were in a minority, it was important to them always to be in their own country where they were the majority. But they've created a situation with the settlements on the West Bank, so there can't be two states, so there can only be one. And if there is one state and everybody is free and equal in it, then they will be a minority again. And so they don't accede to that. So they are between a rock and a hard place. They want neither a two-state solution nor a one state. They just want to perpetuate things as they are,
right,
which is the occupation.
Okay. So you'd prefer a secular state almost.
I think a lot of thinking people, both in Israel and in the West Bank and Gaza, and people outside in the diaspora, because after all, there are millions of Palestinians in the diaspora, and there are Israelis leaving Israel because they don't like the lay of the land. Those people would, many of them would say, yes, we want a secular one state. What this state would be called, how it would work out,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
Nothing is clear.
Well, you know, if you look at what happened in Iraq or things like that with the United States, you don't want a repeat of that.
Right. Well, the United States went in and broke apart everything,
mm-hmm.
and then offered some Elmer's glue to try to stick it back together again. We were very good at destroying. We haven't been good at putting back together.
Let's see. Do you have anything else to add?
No, I just think people, in this country prefer to say, oh, it's so complicated, and throw their hands up in the air and say, it will never be solved. And it is complicated, and maybe it won't be solved. But we actually have a great obligation in this country because we are the major supplier of weapons and money to Israel. And by doing that, we have perpetuated this occupation. We have scolded them for the settlements, but we have never said, you remove those settlements, or else. We're the only ones that have that kind of power. So we have a moral we have perpetuated the occupation right along with them. We have, you know, we have made the leadership of the Palestinian Authority, we have helped to weaken it, to make it look, you know, we have disparaged it, we have treated it with contempt. Yes, there are problems with corruption. Yes, it's an aging, graying elite. But we didn't help strengthen it. We just always criticized, we always disparaged. Meanwhile, whoever was in power in Israel, no matter how right-wing, no matter what kind of atrocities they committed, like Ariel Sharon in the Palestinian refugee camps in 1982, when the Israeli soldiers stood there and allowed the Falange, you know, to kill 2,000 women and children and elderly men, you know, what did we ever do to them? Oh, if that had been committed, you know, by Palestinians, by Arabs, it would have been a huge hue and cry about what awful things they had done and what awful people they were. But no, we just always gave the Israelis a little slap on the wrist, and then things just went on as they always have. And in Israel, really, it's the right wing that wags the tail. The tail of the dog is wagging the rest of the body politic in Israel, and Israelis will tell you this. It's the settler movement. The most extreme right-wing Zionists are controlling the way that country is run and what happens there.
How are Muslim people oppressed in the current system in Israel and in Palestine?
Well, okay. First of all, the Arab villages that exist within Israel proper, we say within the Green Line, and I mentioned that they're mostly in and around Nazareth, they're in Galilee, they don't get nearly the same funding for their schools, for their roads, you know, for their infrastructure. Their kids, you know, live in communities which don't offer the same services as the Jewish communities which are right next door. There are checkpoints every few miles on the roads in the West Bank. Hmm. Your daily movements are sharply curtailed. If you have a West Bank ID and you want to leave the country, you want to fly somewhere, you can't go out through Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. You must cross the Jordan River, where there's a huge checkpoint and a crossing. It's an international boundary. You have to go through the Israeli side, cross the river, go through the Jordanian side before you can go up to Amman to fly out. Coming back, you're coming back into Israel. When you come back, they will keep you outside in the sun waiting for hours. Temperatures can be 120 degrees in the summertime. And they keep people waiting for hours and hours and hours in order to come back in. Okay, so you think you're going to want to fly very often? If you go, you're like, you know, you're going to go. If you're a student, you're going to go and not come back. Your mother might die. You might not come back because it's too hard. It's so inconvenient. It's a hassle, and it's all deliberate.
Why don't more Israeli citizens support the rights of Palestinians or rights of Muslims in Israel?
Well, you know, I guess we can answer that question by saying, you know, why don't we do more for Native Americans in this country?
Well, we gave them the casinos. That's, I mean, pretty much the same thing as the United States, right?
Right. Why don't we support our illegal immigrants? You know, well, we just, you know, they, so essentially Palestinians are being treated like illegal immigrants now are, like, you shouldn't be here, just go away, go back to where you came from. So these were educated people who harbored huge animosity and negative attitudes towards the Palestinians. And these days there just isn't much intermingling. So their incomes dried up, their jobs dried up, their opportunities dried up. And Israelis are now importing laborers from Thailand and Lord knows where all. We don't hear about it, but we've killed. Our military efforts are directly responsible for killing hundreds of thousands of civilians. And we think those people should like us for liberating them. I think most of them would rather still have Saddam Hussein in power, for instance, than what they now have in Iraq. People were extremely angry at the United States. So that empowered them to commit acts of violence against this country, especially 9/11. But in this country, with this country, I know, because I know I have Arab friends who really hate what we've done, even though they might have American friends like us.
So the root of the one possible root of the terrorism that we're seeing these days is the negative acts we have committed towards these predominantly Muslim countries.
Yeah. Okay. And I think that, you know, as time goes on, more and more negative things are said in our own society, in certain aspects of the media, that, you know, are not, they only want to talk about American might and
are you okay? Sorry.
They want to talk about, you know, military might, and they want to see really what are political problems solved militarily. Most of the problems in the world, when you look at them, they're political problems. They're problems of access to freedom and political rights. They're not problems that can be solved by the military. They're problems that need judicious political and diplomatic interventions. And we have an administration now that wants to cut the budget of the State Department and of USAID, which is the development arm of the State Department, and increase dramatically military spending.
Do you see any positivity in that's any improvements within the relations between the Muslims and the Israelis or anything like that?
No.
No.
Yeah, I don't know on what anything positive has been predicated, you know, between the Muslims and Israeli Jews. You're gonna, you know, Israel will find ultimately that it can't continue to occupy another people. I mean, that happens. It's been 50 years, which no one could have imagined. I mean, when I got to the Middle East in 74, they'd been occupying for 7 years. And maybe it was a feature of my own youth at that point, but that seemed like a very long time.
Can you explain what happened 50 years ago?
50 years ago, when you have the June War, which is famously known as the Six-Day War. And simply put, which doesn't really adequately explain everything that happened, but there was a buildup of, there was an escalation of hostility, mostly generated by Egypt, by Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was president at the time, against the Israelis. So he did things like barricade the Straits of Tehran, which is the straits that lead up to the port city of Eilat, which is the only Israeli port city on the Red Sea. Otherwise, they have ports on the Mediterranean, like in Haifa and Ashdod. But he barricaded the straits, and then he requested that the UN peacekeepers who were in the Sinai move. I can't remember if they moved back. So he was rattling, you know, his sabers, which obviously made the Israelis very nervous. There are a lot of things that get said, and words seem to be powerful, but people don't actually intend to act on what they say. So he didn't do anything, and the Israelis decided to make a preemptive strike, and they caught the entire Egyptian Air Force, and they occupied the Sinai. They took over the West Bank from the Jordanians. They occupied the Golan Heights, which are truly heights. They're very high above the Sea of Galilee from the Syrians. And they did this all in 6 days because the Arab armies were very weak, poorly trained, poorly led, and weak. And so the Israelis, of course, were overjoyed because they had destroyed all of the armies, essentially, or stood up to all of the armies around them, surrounding them. All of the hostile forces, you know, were not able to push them back. And I think people thought, oh, well, yeah, this will just be short term, you know, this occupation, these occupations of these various lands, not knowing. And then, of course, the Americans stepped in, kept rearming the Israelis, making sure they had the latest and best military equipment. We would give some too to Jordan. We'd give some, eventually we gave some to Egypt after Camp David, but we never gave them our best stuff. We never sold them our best stuff. We trained them here. We also trained Jordanian officers, Egyptian officers came to this country for military training. And we still do. But, you know, we only want them to be sort of counter deterrents to one another, but we don't want the Arabs to be too strong.
What do you think is the best way or a good way to reduce anti-Palestinian, anti-Muslim sentiment here in this country?
Well, I think actually by showing what life is really like for Palestinians on a daily basis. So a friend of ours, Raja Shahadi, wrote an article that was published in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about what it's like to go through the checkpoints. I think it's stories like that that really, when people read them, when people understand how hard it is for people to live their lives just on a daily basis, that I think that makes people more sympathetic to Palestinians. In the long run, people are supportive of the ones they perceive to be the underdog or the ones they perceive to be mistreated. I think when Israel was first established and we understood about the Holocaust and we knew that there were a lot of Jewish people looking for some place to live, we were more comfortable with saying, yes, they should start their own country and they should call it Israel. But that's changed now. They have this homeland, and yet they're still occupying somebody else's homeland, and wanting to keep them occupied and unfree in their own land.
So playing to people's emotions, essentially, making them
to people's sympathies,
feel
to people's
more
good
sympathetic,
positive sympathy.